This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and today we're going to talk about something interesting and intriguing that's been happening at the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the University of North Dakota School of Medicine and Health Sciences. Joining us today to talk about it, microbial immunologist Jyotika Sharma and David S. Bradley. He is the chair and associate professor of that department. They join us from our Grand Forks studio. Thanks for being with us today, Jyotika and David.
Thank you so much.
Thank
it's really nice to have be here.
Let's start with a brief description from you, Jyotika, about what your research is about.
Okay, my laboratory basically focuses on trying to understand how sepsis develops.
And so sepsis is?
Sepsis is basically a condition of whole body inflammation. So it's a response to some injury or an infection which just goes berserk, which just goes uncontrolled.
Is this what we used to call occasionally blood poisoning?
Yes, that's another name for it. But in the medical terms, that's a very, non-specific kind of term. So we don't like to use that anymore.
Fair enough. Proceed.
So that's what we are interested in understanding, and particularly pneumonia. It usually leads to sepsis development. And so we want to understand what is so different about the lung that when you get pneumonia or pneumonic infections, that leads to sepsis development.
Is this bacterial infection we're talking about?
Yes. So what we do is we, in our laboratory, we infect mice with different bacterial pathogens to induce pneumonia, and then we see how they proceed to develop sepsis.
And what happens when an area of the body is infected or injured that results in sepsis? What's the actual mechanics of it?
So that's something which is really interesting, and it's not very well understood, because what happens is, particularly in case of respiratory or pneumonic infections, you are inhaling air every day. You are inhaling things. You are getting infections also. But, you know, you don't know that. Those sort of things are going on in your body because the kind of immune response you generate in day-to-day inhaling of air, that can take care of those infections. So this is what we call resolving inflammation. So you get infected and then inflammation happens, the infection is taken care of, and the inflammation resolves. But in case of disorders or diseases like sepsis, what happens is that inflammation doesn't resolve. It goes to an uncontrolled level. So how that balance between a resolving inflammation and non-resolving inflammation, how that balance is tipped, that's what we are trying to understand.
And what have you discovered?
So we have found that there is a molecule in our body. It seems like that it is, partially at least, is controlling that balance in some way. So what happens is that when you get infected with something, there is a type of immune cell called neutrophils. They are called the first responder cells.
And these are like white blood cells?
Yes. So they come to the site of infection or injury, and they start to do things, produce chemicals which are going to take care of the infection. But in normal case or in normal resolving inflammation, what happens is that when those neutrophils have taken care of the infection, they are supposed to die off and then get cleared. But in the non-resolving inflammation, they hang around for much longer periods of time. So what we have seen that there is, in the absence of a particular molecule in our body, those neutrophils get to hang around longer, and that causes trouble in the long run.
Molecular level, that's quite a small level to be looking at here.
That, yes.
That's amazing. Now, what happens when these neutrophils do their job is we see this white stuff, that's pus, right?
Yes. So that pus is actually full of these cells, neutrophils. So what they do is when they sense some sort of infection or injury, they start to produce chemicals we call cytokines and chemokines and a lot of other things. They start to clear those infection off, or that pathogen or whatever bacteria is causing the infection. So that starts to get clear off. But the problem is that those chemicals can also cause tissue damage as well. So it's a very non-specific kind of response. So these cells, they just know that when they sense an infection or injury, they have to produce these chemicals. So they are very non-specific kind of chemicals. So if we do not control, or if these cells get to hang around much longer, they just keep on producing those chemicals, and that is going to cause trouble for the host itself.
Now, we've heard in the past term called flesh-eating bacteria. Is this somehow related to that in terms of this unable to stop this and unable to turn it off?
No, it's a little different, because what you are talking about is a pathogen or the bacteria-mediated response. So whatever they are producing to eat our flesh, that's something different.
Those
chemicals are different. But these chemicals, which these neutrophils are producing, they are supposed to be protective. They are supposed to help us. But if they are not controlled, or if they are not produced in a controlled manner, they can cause trouble too.
And do we know what causes them to become out of control?
No, that's the big question in this field right now. So that is what a lot of labs all over the world are trying to understand. So we are really excited that we have found this molecule which is possibly associated with this phenomenon.
So now that you've found the molecule, the next stage in the research is to figure out a way to turn it off?
Or? Yes. Next stage would be, now we have indicated that it is somehow involved in this process of turning these neutrophils off. So how is it doing that? Because the first thing we would like to see is whether, in case of septic patients, what is happening with this molecule? Is it not present altogether, or is it there but it is not able to function well?
David, can we speak just for a moment here about the significance of this kind of issue, the sepsis? How big of an issue is it for hospitals and healthcare facilities?
It's in the $15 to $20 billion a year range. It's huge. The inability of some people, for whatever reason, to shut off inflammation can lead to, first, as Jordika has talked about, tissue damage, but ultimately organ failure and finally death. So, I mean, this is having an ability or having the idea that we might at some point in time in the future have the ability to downregulate this response for the clinician is a wonderful step forward.
So how is the research money for this kind of research? I mean, it would strike me that that's a fair amount of cash that could be saved if this off switch could be perfected.
Yes, I would assume so. But again, as I mentioned, that there is still a lot needed to be done. It's just an indication. And since sepsis itself is a very, very complex disorder, it's a lot of things go wrong in the body. And so I'm assuming that it's not going to take only one molecule to shut this whole thing off. Mm-hmm. Since it's such a complex disorder, it is going to take a sort of a combination of a lot of things to tackle this kind of immune disorder.
Well, when we think small, we think atoms and molecules. And so how do you actually do the research on the molecular level?
Oh, well, what we do in the lab, particularly for this molecule, we have experimental mice which have been manipulated in such a way that they don't express or they do not have this molecule. We call them knockout mice strains. So we have mice which do have this molecule, and then we have mouse strains which do not have this molecule. So then we infect them with bacteria and then compare the response between the two. So we know that whatever difference we are seeing in the knockout animals is because of the absence of this molecule.
And what is next in the research for you? What are you looking at next?
Oh, well, as I mentioned, that first we need to see, or I would be interested in seeing what exactly is happening in septic patients as far as the expression or presence or absence of this molecule is concerned, whether those septic patients, and not just the septic patients, I must say that this resolving versus non-resolving inflammation, it's not just associated with sepsis, but a lot of other diseases, for example, arthritis and a lot of diseases which are atherosclerosis, thickening of arteries, those sort of diseases where there is no infection involved per se, but there is just non-resolving inflammation.
Yes.
So this kind of research has implications for those disorders as well. And so this is something really important to mention, that initially sepsis itself was also considered as a disease which is driven by an infection. But now studies from our laboratory and other laboratories all over the world, they have started to show that it's not just the infection, it's not just the pathogen which is doing this. It's host's response itself, immune response itself, which is contributing to the development
it's
of these
It's the inflammation.
Diseases. Exactly, exactly.
Wow, that's very interesting, because there you mentioned a number of other things like arthritis that mm-hmm. involve inflammation. So mm-hmm. understanding that process at the molecular level could have very wide-ranging applications.
Yes, yes, you are absolutely right. Yeah.
David, besides Jyotika's research, what are you watching with interest right now in the field of microbiology and immunology, your department's name?
Well, here in Grand Forks, we have a growing group of people that are looking at host-pathogen interactions, people we broadly call people looking at infectious diseases. And we have a group that's working on Yersinia pestis.
What is that?
That is the causative agent of the plague, the Black Plague.
Wow.
Which is, as with the organism that Jyotika works with, is there at the top of the select agent list, looking at how people that survive, actually how their immune systems work, hoping to reach from that something that might be useful for developing a vaccine or therapeutic. There are collaborations from our department with some of the growing biotechs here in town. My lab, for example, is very interested and therapeutic antibodies for emerging viral diseases, and we have had quite a bit of success at the preclinical stage and are working towards IND and FDA testing for that. There is a group that is working hard on vector-borne diseases, specifically looking at Lyme's disease and how the host responds to Lyme's disease. So there's a lot of really, really cool stuff going on here. People looking at Pseudomonas infections in the lung. So their work sort of overlaps with Jyotika's, but a different organism in a different situation. Cystic fibrosis patients have huge problems with Pseudomonas infections and understanding how you can tweak the immune system. Because as Jyotika has already explained with her work, they found the molecule, and you might think very simplistically that you'd want to turn that molecule on or off as a therapy, but the other thing it allows you to do is it allows you to look inside at the cell signaling and how the body actually responds, what happens when you signal that receptor, and that might even be a better target for therapy. So we have a lot of people that are looking right at the junction of host-pathogen interactions here in the Grand Forks area, both academic and some of the commercial partners that have moved here. So we have a really growing sort of a nucleus of investigators that are asking, we think, important questions about how you might, first understanding how the response occurs, how the host responds, and second, how you might utilize that to develop a vaccine or a therapy.
So it's not just something that revolves around this research into a bacterial effect. There's potential, depending on how these molecules interact in this inflammation process, it would have application to viral infections or immune system disorders? Or
it would certainly have an effect in viral diseases. It would have an effect in autoimmune diseases. And you know, as Jyotika has already mentioned, atherosclerosis is huge, and that there's a chronic underlying inflammation that's associated with that. And so if her work were able to show the mechanism by which you could turn that off, and it might be so simplistic as triggering that receptor, but more likely triggering the underlying signaling pathways within the cells, you could drastically change disease processes way beyond the particular bacteria that she works with.
I went online and looked at Jyotika's Vita there, and under the research interest, she is describing these host-derived molecules as Alarmins. I thought that was an interesting name for because that's what they do, right? They sort of sound the alarm.
Yes, that's exactly why they are named that way. It's basically a family of molecules which are supposed to be contained within a live cell. So what happens is that in scenario of an inflammation or an injury, the cells die. A lot of cells die. So if those cells are not taken care of in a timely fashion, all these things which are coming out of these cells, they get into the extracellular milieu or outside of the cells. And then what happens is the system or the immune system, it thinks or sees them as danger signals or alarmins because those molecules are not supposed to be outside. They are supposed to be contained within the cell. So that's why we call them alarmins. So it's a very fascinating area of research we are pursuing right now, looking at the role of those alarmins in inflammation, basically.
David, we often think of the University of North Dakota and big places like that for higher education. As you know, they're primarily aimed at educating people and all that kind of thing. But there is a research function here that people would probably be pretty impressed with. I'm impressed with what I've just heard, as a matter of fact. So talk a bit about the importance of a place like UND for that.
Well, there's no question. Research is critical. And, you know, research and education, at least within in our department, certainly within the School of Medicine, are intimately associated. Much of the research that we've talked about today, both Joydica's and the others we've talked about in my lab and others, is graduate student-centric. Our graduate students play a huge role in that. And so the research and the education go hand in hand with that, and it's a real learning opportunity, a real training ground for people getting master's or PhDs. But we also have a lot of undergraduates that come into our research labs and get hands-on experience, and they may not be going into basic research. They may be going to med school, dental school, or some field completely different, but it gives them an opportunity to experience research, to you know, sort of get their hands wet in the process and learn. So we don't really see the research and the education as separate entities. We see that sort of as a commingled process that we undergo, but I think we also the research also allows us to really reach out for real everyday solutions. We're doing research to understand very basic processes, but these very basic processes can then be translated into a preclinical and then clinical applications. So the research really is hopefully more than just an educational exercise. We're answering real problems.
And Joytika's research has been getting a fair amount of attention. I noted that it's going to be written up in the Journal of Leukocyte Biology with a separate editorial. That's a pretty big deal, I take it.
That is, yeah. When you get a separate editorial or recognition like that, that suggests that people outside of Grand Forks, outside of North Dakota, have looked at her work and think that this finding or this set of findings are really important in the field. And I think that kind of recognition it's great for her, it's great for the program. It's always good to have somebody who isn't intimately involved be able to critique the work and say, yeah, this is really important. This step is something we should get excited about.
Joytika, when you were an undergraduate at Delhi University in New Delhi, India, did you envision yourself at the University of North Dakota, Grand Forks?
No, not really, particularly since I'm not a winter person.
So you're indoors right now,
I think. Yes. No, but it's really exciting. I'm really fortunate to be in a field where I get the opportunity to contribute toward whatever little I can. But just seeing this kind of response to your research, it's really heartening and it's really encouraging.
Well, thank you very much for shedding some light on it for us today. It sounds very interesting, and best wishes in your future endeavors along this line and others. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Joytika Sharma is a microbial immunologist with the Department of Microbiology and Immunology in the UND School of Medicine and Health Sciences. And David Bradley is chair and associate professor in that department. Thanks for joining us today. More Main Street in a moment.
Support for this program is provided by the North Dakota Education Association, an organization of 8,000 school employees working to ensure great public schools for every child.
Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public starts with the 2013 Rough Rider Awards Ceremony featuring Louise Erdrich. Then at 8 Central, Doc Martin. And at 9, Dirk Gently, a British comedy detective drama. Tune in tonight on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. In the background, Southwest Portals is the name of the CD, composed, arranged, and produced by Bruce Lofgren. He plays guitar, and Doug Livingston is on that device called pedal steel. A little Southwest Portals. Well, Chuck Lura has our Natural North Dakota essay each week. He, of course, teaches at Dakota College at Bottineau. And this week, he's talking about the Chase Lake National Wildlife Refuge.
Perhaps like you, I don't have any particular interest as to when the swallows return to Capistrano. But I will know that all is well with the world when I hear that the pelicans have returned to Chase Lake National Wildlife Refuge. Chase Lake is one of the first national wildlife refuges. It was established by President Roosevelt back in 1908 to protect the American white pelicans, which nest there and were threatened at the time by indiscriminate killing. The refuge lies in the western Stutsman County, about 15 miles northwest of Medina, which is just off Interstate 94 west of Jamestown, and today is home to one of the largest, if not the largest, nesting colony of American white pelicans in North America. The refuge consists of a little over 4,000 acres, about half of which is Chase Lake, with the remainder mostly supporting native mixed grass prairie. It might surprise you, but most of the refuge is designated as a wilderness area. This is under the protection of the Wilderness Protection Act of 1964. The number of nesting pelicans in the refuge generally number in the lower tens of thousands. For example, in the year 2000, there are over 35,000 breeding pelicans at Chase Lake. They nest on the ground of small islands in the lake. Chase Lake, however, is so alkaline that it doesn't support a fish population, so the pelicans have to feed elsewhere. They're known to fly up to 100 miles in search of their food supply, which is largely tiger salamanders and crayfish. Most everyone that lives within 100 miles or so of Chase Lake commonly observes flocks of pelicans. Small flocks can often be observed overhead, flapping their large wings as they gain altitude, followed by a downward glide and perhaps banking to the left or right, and then repeating the procedure. At times they circle an area in this way for several minutes. They really are avian grace in motion. Chase Lake National Wildlife Refuge has been designated as one of the 500 most important bird areas by the American Bird Conservancy. The next time you travel I-94 near Medina, consider visiting this important home to the American white pelican. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Chuck Lura is also a member of the Prairie Public Radio Council, so he performs multiple functions for us, and we thank him for that. And now it's time for the news with Danielle, and I guess we're looking at the water in the Red River still, and where is it going to end?
Yes, we'll have to find out. The city of Fargo continues to plug away at flood preparations as the Red River begins its steady climb above flood stage. Nathan Borboom is a city engineer. He says the city is finishing up sandbag deliveries where they are needed, and that the Corps of Engineers is still working on constructing clay levees. He says now is about the time that residents will notice road closures around the city.
We're getting to those river stages where we need to start closing 2nd Street south and north here and start building our temporary levees. The core contractors will get going a little bit heavier again with the clay levees down here where they acquire a lot of dirt out on 2nd Street. But then we also are going to kick off into full steam with our volunteer effort on placing sandbags behind the homes.
Borboom says the volunteer effort will need to be strong over the weekend as temperatures rise and the water starts coming up faster. He says the city plans to sandbag to 40 feet and construct clay levees to 42 feet. The latest forecast from the National Weather Service places the Red River at Fargo at 38 feet next Thursday, with no concrete crest prediction yet. North Dakota's Workers' Compensation Agency says the premiums employers pay will be reduced by 0.7% starting July 1st. Brian Klipfel is the Executive Director of Workforce Safety and Insurance.
We still have 141 rate classifications, and so there's some rate classes where it may go up a little bit, but the majority of them are the rate classes are going to be decreased. You know, the other thing that I think we have to keep in mind in this is that the state's average annual wage has gone up. And so when we look at our premiums collected, you know, we look at 70% of the state average annual wage, so that's gone up too. So with that increase, there is, again, more money being collected by some employers, but we're just saying that the premium rate will be relatively stable, in fact, going down 0.7%.
Klipfel says some oil field-related industries are seeing a bigger-than-average decrease in their rates. He says that shows that safety is being taken seriously in the oil patch. And Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner says it will be hard to come up with $350 million in individual and corporate income tax relief without sacrificing some priorities. Right now, the Senate has gone along with Governor Dalrymple's plan to cut individual income taxes by $100 million and corporate taxes by $25 million. The House had passed over $500 million in income tax cuts, and House Majority Leader Al Carlson says he wants to get a $350 million income tax relief package out of this session. But Wardner says,
right now, it looks like we're going to have a hard time coming up with the money to go to $350 million if we want to take care of some of our other priorities. And those priorities are property tax relief and getting money out to the oil country in western North Dakota.
Wardner says the House and Senate have agreed on about $714 million in property tax breaks, but he says that number would have to be reduced to give more income tax breaks. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Welcome back to Main Street. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Distress, anxiety, sadness, depression, that last word in particular, that's one of those words that's often said in a whisper and sometimes only after some reservation. It can be difficult to diagnose, both because there's an unclear line between occasional sadness and anxiety and depression, and couple that with the reluctance to admit when there's a problem. And whether someone is a little distressed or more, there are resources for help. I'm joined by Dr. Myron Veenstra. He is the director of the University Counseling Center at the University of North Dakota, and Lori Bedding, the Associate Vice President for Health and Wellness at UND. The university has been studying students who are in distress and just launched a 21st century way to help. Thanks to you both for joining us today.
Thank you. It's our pleasure to be here.
Dr. Veenstra, before we get into some of the new resources for students here, let's start with an overview here. The study looks at students who are distressed and even depressed. First off, how are those two different?
Well, certainly depression starts putting a drag on the person's cognitive functioning. So concentration can be impaired, memory, they can easily develop a sleep disorder. Sleep is essential in memory consolidation. So they start running into academic difficulties, which then starts adding to their stress, which then loops back into depression.
Sounds like a vicious circle.
It is, and certainly in modern times, these students are very key about family and being successful for the sake of family. So they will carry a lot of burdens about, are they good enough for the amount of money that's going into all this effort?
What are some of the warning signs?
Well, in conversations with them, you'll hear a certain tone of negativity, doubts, a lack of joy and successes, more of a focus on what I didn't do well enough, changes in sleep pattern, of course, changes in use of alcohol and drugs, which may be harder for parents to see but can be seen on campus. And by the way, with students in general, we encourage them to be what we would call a brother's or sister's keeper. So if you see changes in behavior, that is something to pay attention to, and they would be more likely to see changes in drinking. On the job here, students who work in various departments in the university might see a fall off in their work productivity, late to work, not as effective.
A UND study for the year 2012 here found 21.3% of students on campus felt so depressed that it was difficult to function. 6.9% seriously considered suicide, and out of that, 1.5% actually attempted suicide. Is there something about college life, for want of a better term here, that brings out depression? Or what is it about this age and what's going on in their lives?
Well, there's several things going on all at once. The first I alluded to is their family connections are profound, so they are carrying the banner for family. The second thing is that they are competing against the entire world. They know that jobs are exported. They know that people come in on visas. So there's a lot of stress, a lot of comparisons to other cultures. And, of course, there is the element of the economy. These days, the market has not looked good. It's starting to reopen now, but they've carried a lot of concerns about, I did all this, I have all this loans overhanging. When I graduate, what will be out there for me?
Do you find that it crosses the lines between gender, class, ethnicity differently?
Well, I am impressed with students, at least at UND, is that there is these strong family connections. So what might have been cultural differences in the past, you know, when you think about the importance of success is a family effort. So I don't see cultural differences that way. Males, of course, are more of a persuasion to push on through. So they can tend to ignore their feelings and not be as inclined to seek counseling. So we do see a greater percentage of women coming into the counseling center for depression and stress.
Well, Lori, let's bring you into the conversation here. What kinds of resources are available, you know, beyond just going to see the counselor at a university?
Well, actually, the launch of our new program, if you were, is really just a way for us to connect and collaborate with what have been deep and ongoing resources for students on campus. One that isn't commonly thought of is the Dean of Students' Office. Unfortunately, some associate with, you know, I've sanctioned, I'm in some kind of trouble. But truly, the Dean of Students' Office is there to serve students and families, concerned faculty, staff members, with really trying to connect them with whatever resources they need to be academically successful. And, you know, you can just call in with a question, and they're more than willing to assist you. And that's part of what we're trying to communicate with this site. As a whole, too, we have partners in the housing office and certainly with all our students that live within the residence hall. The training, whether you're at an RA or a hall director, is very comprehensive in recognizing signs and symptoms and knowing how to respond and react. Student health is another area. I've seen research that suggests that upward to 70% of students that walk into a student health clinic actually are there with some type of mental health undertone, if not as a primary symptom. And so the connection between the counseling center and student health is very intentional, a lot of cross-referral. We also have the Women's Center here on campus that is able to respond uniquely to women's needs, and we're in the process of deploying a sexual respect and sexual violence prevention specialist. So, and again, we have crisis coordination teams, you know, folks that are first responders for specific emergency type situations.
What do you think usually stops students from seeking out help?
Well, there's good news in that direction. Over the past 2 years, there's been a 45% increase in the number of students coming into the counseling center. And walk-in crisis has increased by 170%. So one of the things that is going on these days is there's less stigma about counseling. So, yeah, there are certainly students that are needing to come in. Fully 80% of students who commit suicide were not seen at any counseling center when you look nationwide. So we launched a special program called the Interactive Screening Program, which sends out emails to the students and it invites them into taking a self-assessment and email conversation that is encrypted so that we can talk to those students that are reticent to come in, who don't want to come through our doors, to engage them in a discussion about suicide before they even have to make that decision to see us.
And these things stay anonymous?
Yeah.
Until they say otherwise anyway?
Yeah, until they come in, they know that they don't have to worry about a police welfare check. They can be fully honest about how awful they are feeling.
What should people do who are concerned about somebody? How do you talk to somebody you think needs help?
Well, the website gives some tips and directions that are useful to think about. Small conversations. Don't push the student towards why you should feel better. You have a lot to live for. Oddly enough, invite them into a heart-to-heart discussion of what feels so awful for them. The other offering that is available is that they can call the counseling center or dean of students to talk about what they're hearing from that student, how should they proceed, what kinds of decisions could be affected to reach back to the student, and just more in general about how do you make a conversation with someone that is so depressed.
And now you've just launched this website that we've alluded to a couple of times here, UND Cares. Would you kind of walk me through this site quickly, tell me how it works?
Certainly. The intent was, again, to find and create a clear path for students, faculty, staff, parents, really anyone who's concerned about the welfare of a student, to understand not only the signs and symptoms, but to understand a clear path for conversations and referral. And we have, in fact, the site was launched on Tuesday, and within an hour, we received an email from the parent of an international student that said, you know, fantastic, well thought out, huge weight off my mind as a mother of an international student who's so far from home. So well done, UND. And it is really, it provides a level of comfort, you know, certainly in those crisis situations. We are very capable of responding. But as you alluded to earlier with the data, we have a lot of students that are really just from time to time in a fairly dark place that need perhaps someone to be that listening ear. And students often seek faculty, staff, or other students as their first line. And so we want them to be able to know what to do.
Well, they tend to kind of fill that role. You're away from your family sometimes by, you know, thousands of miles and away from that, just that support system. The university really has to fill in that role. One thing that I saw on the UND Cares website is some things that people might just think is fairly run-of-the-mill for college students, you know, anxiety, sleep difficulty, finances. When do those become more than just run-of-the-mill problems? When are they really issues?
Well, when they start stacking up and you're seeing a cascade towards the negative, of course, as parents and adults, we will say, these should be the happiest days of your life. But if you're seeing an individual that takes no joy, if the things that they used to participate in, they no longer participate in, again, alcohol and drugs can be a common escape. The financial problems, again, Lori Bedding has initiated programming that helps address that with students.
Such as?
Well, in January of this year, we actually, due to conversations with students that were very concerned about not only mounting debt, but the stresses that they were seeing in the lives of their peers, we launched a financial wellness services program. It is peer-led, or one-on-one counseling sessions that deal with everything from how to budget to, you know, dealing with student loans and repayment. And really the driving factor here is stress and anxiety. And so we do pre-post measures, and we also are doing some longer-term follow-up with these folks to see whether or not they've been able to, had some behavior change as far as their overall financial management, but more importantly, have we improved the quality of life, and does that lead to better academic success, retention, graduation rates?
And again, everything from financial worries to general illnesses like cold, sore throats, to stresses and anxieties, to outright depression. There are tips for all of those. And that website, again, could you give it exactly?
Certainly. It is UND, let me find that here.
A Google search for UND Cares.
UND Cares,
would
right.
find it for yes. sure. Okay. Well, Dr. Myron Veenstra is the director of the Counseling Center at UND, and Lori Bedding is the associate vice president for health and wellness, also at UND. Thanks to you both for your time today.
Thank you.
Hope to have been of help.
What's happening is next.
Hey, Peter Sagal here, and if you're not busy on May 2nd, I was hoping you'd like to come to the movies with me. Wait, wait, don't tell me. We'll be broadcast live to movie screens all over the country. Come on, it'll be fun.
That's coming up May 2nd at the Grand Theater in Bismarck and Century 10 in Fargo at 7 p.m. More information at prairiepublic.org/radio.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's Thursday, and that's the question. What's going on? What's happening? Ashley Thornburg is here with me to go through her list. I've got my list. We've got our little zinger of the week. You go right ahead.
Extreme North Dakota Spring Primer Adventure Race.
Oh, no. We know it's going to be rough.
This is just the last few hours to register here. Registration actually closes at midnight. So if you want to take part in this race, you have till midnight to register for this. This is an annual sprint distance race designed for newbies to adventure racing. So it's harder than a regular race, but it's not quite as hardcore as some adventure racing. You'll get your feet wet, muddy, maybe even blistered, and see how you like what's being built as the second hardest race in North Dakota. The race itself is at Turtle River State Park, which is about 30 miles west of Grand Forks, and it's $50 per racer. And again, registration closes at midnight. The race itself is on Saturday at 10 a.m.
I've got one that is actually this evening at 6:30, so it doesn't help our 7 o'clock listeners very much. But this is 50 extraordinary letters written by Dakota men imprisoned after the U.S.-Dakota War of 1862. It's this evening at 6:30 at Zanbro's Variety in downtown Fargo. Dakota elders Clifford Kanku and Michael Simon, their fluent Dakota speakers, provide both the Dakota transcription and the first published English translation of 50 of these letters. So that's this evening, 6:30 at Zanbro's in Fargo.
In Valley City, some student-directed one-act plays here. This is taking place at Theater 320 at the VCSU campus, and shows go through Saturday. Friday and Saturday shows are at 7:30 p.m., and there's also a Saturday matinee at 2 p.m. Adults are $10, seniors are $5, and students are free.
The Arts Center in Jamestown presents the Orchestra of Fez. Hear the world-renowned Orchestra of Fez and experience the melodies that inspire dancing in the streets of Fez, Rabat, and Casablanca. This is Saturday at 7:30 at the Ryland Fine Arts Center. Tickets at the door, adults $10, and Arts Center members $8. Kids are free. This is all part of the Caravan Sarai experience in Jamestown this year.
In Minot, the Chamber Chorale, Spring Choral, and Ice Cream Sampler. So if listening to good music is not enough, they're also throwing in some ice cream. This is Sunday at 3 p.m. at the First Lutheran Church in Minot. No admission, but a free will offering is accepted. And this is the season ender for the chorale here. They're singing many vocal favorites, modern compositions, spirituals, and folk songs.
Well, I'll stay in Minot because tomorrow, Minot State University's Dome will come alive with tradition, color, and movement. Native American dancers and drum groups from throughout North Dakota and neighboring states and provinces will compete during the 24th annual Native American Spring Honor Dance and Powwow Celebration that extends through Saturday. Admission to the Spring Honor Dance and Powwow Celebration is $2 for ages 12 to 55, free to children under 12, senior citizens, and MSU, that is Minot State University students, faculty, and staff.
Here's a real high-flying event on Sunday in Grafton, the Fly-In. Well, it's also called a drive-in, walk-in. walk-in, bike-in, apparently however you can get there, breakfast from the Experimental Aircraft Association. This is 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. The pancakes, eggs, ham. There's more than 380 members of this chapter, and they are providing breakfast and no-cost first flights for children 8 to 17 years old who are there with a parent.
And have you heard the Bully Pulpit Golf Course is opening on April 27th. It opens Saturday. It opens for the 2013 season. The course will be open through mid-October. This is a sign of spring. For more information, you can go online to medora.com/bullypulpit.
Saturday is cleanup day in Williston, so get out there, do your civic duty in advance of the 81st annual Band Day celebration. 81 years, you know this is a big event. Meet at Davidson Park at 8:30 on Saturday morning for your volunteering assignment. Gloves and garbage bags will be provided, as will lunch. Why do all of my events always have food in there?
I can think of a reason.
Somebody's hungry. Be at 1 p.m., and again, that's this Saturday in Williston.
The Magic Flute, follow the adventures of Prince Tamino and Papageno, the bird catcher, as they set forth to rescue Princess Pamina in this colorful fairy tale by Mozart. It's Friday at 7:30 and Sunday at 2 o'clock at Festival Concert Hall. That's the NDSU Opera presenting The Magic Flute. Tickets are $3 for students, $10 for seniors, and $13 for adults.
The Bismarck Mandan Civic Chorus is presenting the music of Tom Porter, who has headed up the Civic Chorus. And this concert showcases his music and features guest choirs. This is at the Belle Mayhus on Saturday at 7:30. Adults are $12. Students and seniors are $8. Tickets are available at Eckroth Music and thebismanchorus.com.
Back to Minot State University for Dead Man Cell Phone. It's from their Department of Theater Arts, a play by Sarah Rule. It runs through the 27th. That Saturday, it is performed in the MSU Black Box Theater in Hartnett Hall. There's a name with some significance. The showtime is at 7:30. The box office opens at 7. Ticket prices are $6 for adults and seniors and students, $5. And seniors and students off campus, $5, and MSU students, faculty, and staff free with their MSU ID.
I'll stick with Minot here. This is their first ever teen poetry slam coming up this weekend, again at the Hartnett Hall on the campus of Minot State University, Sunday at 2 p.m., featuring nationally acclaimed slam poet Big Papa E.
With
open mic night to follow.
Big Papa E. Well, here's my pick for the week, okay? The libraries, that is the Fargo Libraries Family History Research Series, starts this Sunday. It's their four-part genealogy series in the main library. The sessions are taught by librarian Diane Briggs and local genealogy expert Les Bakke. It covers different parts of the family history research process. You know it's going to be pretty comprehensive. You can take any or all of the sessions, but space is limited. Pre-registration is required, and you can register online at fargolibrary.org or contact the main library information desk.
I'm going with Healthy Kids for my event of the week, and this is at the Downtown YMCA in Fargo on Saturday from 1 to 4. There's open swimming, finger painting, family yoga, and Zumba. You can do crafts. You can learn about healthy snacks. There's going to be door prizes and so much more. It's free. It's open to the public. It's a good way for those kids to get the wiggles out for the hopefully last weekend before they can just play outside already.
All right. Well, it's getting to be spring fever time out there. The sun is shining in parts of the state at any rate. The temperature is starting to go up. We're looking at the 60s, I hear, for the weekend. We can't wait, but we've got Dakota Datebook coming up.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 25th. Donald Arneson was the son of a widowed carpenter from Hillsboro who fought with North Dakota's 164th Regiment during World War II. After the war, he went to NDSU, but a year after, he decided to re-enlist. Now, 28, Arneson was serving in Japan when the Korean War broke out in 1950, and he was soon back on the battlefield. Casualties were horrific that summer and fall, and as winter approached, the possibility of defeating North Korea seemed promising. But everything changed in late November when hundreds of thousands of Chinese troops entered the war. When spring arrived, Arneson was one of the only original soldiers of his unit still standing. In the third week of April 1951, his 35th Regiment was positioned near the center of the Korean Peninsula, where the Chinese had been setting huge fires in recent days. The smoke obscured their movements from reconnaissance planes, a sure sign they were massing for a major offensive. Arneson's regiment was positioned near the Turkish Brigade, whose warriors were considered ferocious on the battlefield. As the sun went down on April 22nd, a heavy barrage of artillery fire started falling on the Turks' positions. After 3 hours of constant pounding, the barrage lifted, and thousands of Chinese foot soldiers swarmed out of the darkness. The clash was so aggressive that both sides engaged in hand-to-hand combat. Even though the Turks were exceptionally skilled with combat knives, they were outnumbered, and the Chinese started breaking through their lines. As the sun rose, the Turkish brigade found itself nearly surrounded and was forced to fall back. While both sides reorganized for the next round, Arneson's 35th Regiment quickly rushed forward to replace the Turkish brigade. The next Chinese attack came the night of April 25th, and the Americans suffered more than 150 casualties by the time they were ordered to fall back the following morning. That was the last time Arneson was seen alive, and 2 days later, he was listed as killed in action. But his remains were not found, and when the Korean Truce was signed in 1953, there were hopes the Hillsborough soldier, as well as 8,000 other missing men, would show up during prisoner exchanges. But it was not to be. Master Sergeant Arneson was declared dead several months later, and a memorial marker for him was eventually placed in the Ringsacker Cemetery east of Buxton. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Tomorrow, Main Street, we'll head down another Main Street. The Old Red Old Ten Scenic Byway is the North Dakota Tourism Organization of the Year, and we'll hear from past president Robin Reynolds. And speaking of tourism, another event.
Another great thing is about to happen. The Roosevelt Zoo in Minot is just about to open for the first time since that devastating flood back in 2011. So they've gone through a whole year without being able to have this great tourist destination open, and they are getting ready. Spring will be here.
The Minot Zoo. The animals are getting out, too. And, of course, it'll be Friday, so that's the day that Prairie Public's news director Dave Thompson comes by, and he and I chew over the week's news events. And, of course, the legislature's getting close to finishing up, and there'll probably be lots of stuff happening near the end of the session, as usual. And Madeline comes by on Fridays to give a movie review. This time he's going to talk about 42, the Jackie Robinson story, that famous color line that was crossed in 1947 in the major leagues. So we'll hear from that, and of course, whatever else crosses our way on the day tomorrow, Friday, a beautiful day before the weekend. In the meantime, have a great evening.